I interviewed to be a teacher at an all-girls school, and they came in second for the job. And she, after they watched me engaging with the sixth graders, she said, you know, I can tell you're a feminist. And I knew what she was saying, and I agreed with her on one level. But on another level, I wanted to clarify. And when I read The Ambassador from Venus, Lisa Jarno's book on the life of Robert Duncan, I came across a very interesting quote that he gave at a reading in March 23, 1976 at the University of San Diego. And he said, he was talking about groups of writers, and he said, I would have questions about any of the new minority movements simply because it seems to me that the whole issue of our time is that we barely hold on to writing as human beings, which is the hardest thing of all to do. To write as a woman or to write as a man or to write as a black or to write as a gay poet is absolutely minor compared with how do we hold this new human consciousness.
Oh, that's lovely. That's beautiful. Yeah.
So, and you're saying back in 1963 that Duncan was aware of things that Olson wasn't because of his orientation. And Duncan in the 40s came out as a gay man, which took a lot of guts.
It did. It certainly did.
And it also, it denied him certain opportunities. And my mother was born in Cuba, but I don't go around with the banner of the Cuban-American poet. Maybe because my Spanish is so bad. Maybe because I am inherently, I think, seeking that nobility that Duncan alluded to. And yet I know the situation for women writers on this continent and probably worse in other places around the world. And yet there's something about what Duncan says to me that seems very real and authentic and true and something that I want to strive for.
Well, okay, I agree. The human consciousness is what's at stake here, especially in our capitalist consumerist culture. I think there are steps on the way to liberating that consciousness. And for me, feminism was a very crucial step. I also find, for instance, Susan Griffin's critique of how women are situated in relationship to Mother Earth, to nature, all of that. That's still current in people's minds. Even though there's been this critique that's been going on by a number of feminist writers for a long time. For me, I think now my major issue is not... There's a lot of things going on in my mind at the moment. Okay, so identity consciousness. My studies in Buddhism work against that because identity is just another thing that we are attached to, that we cling to, that we limit ourselves by. And right now, it seems to me the pressure is on for people to focus on what is happening to our environment because we are making it unsustainable so rapidly that there isn't time, in a sense, for the gender battles anymore. Even though the gender battles and its critique is crucial to an understanding of what has been happening and why it's been happening.
They come from the same impulse.
Yes, that's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But and I hear what you're saying, and I think it's beautiful. There are steps on the way. I think that there's a difference between this kind of identity poetics that seems to have, and I do not mean any disrespect, but you can kind of get a sense with certain writers that there's a sort of victimhood.
Yes,
about
exactly.
And I don't mean that disrespectfully.
No, I know.
Or as
I
the
know.
Great American philosopher Naomi Judd said, the first time you're a victim, after that you're a volunteer.
Yes, trenchant.
there's a couple more things I'd like to cover. One of them is... Charles Bernstein has a book called Attack of the Difficult Poems, and the notion that your work is more difficult, it requires a little more investment, it requires a little more than casual reading. It seems to me yours is the kind of work that I'm most after in my own work and in the work that I'm interested in reading, and that is that it takes you a while before you get a permission, and at a certain point you sort of fall in and get how the person's mind works. Okay.
So that's nicely said. Very nicely said.
I'm going to transcribe it and write it down so I can remember. But in the U.S., it's not the quote-unquote difficult poets that get the quote-unquote recognition. You know, we have Mary Oliver and Billy Collins our Emily Dickinson and Walt Whitman. And in Canada, we have you and George Bowring and Fred Waugh and others. I mean, George and Fred were Parliamentary Poets Laureate. Mm-hmm. So they were recognized at the highest level of this recognition, if that means anything. And, you know, if we go back to your Buddhist teachings, it probably doesn't.
No,
it probably hinders.
Mm-hmm. But I would say it did, yes. Having watched Fred struggle with time during his position, I just think that's not anything that I would want to have to do.
But it says a lot between the difference between Canada and the U.S. that we have Mary Oliver and Billy Collins, and no disrespect to them. You know, the poetry is a big house, and we have many rooms, and they're entitled to theirs, but it seems to me there's a difference between Canada and the U.S. just based on looking at that.
That's partly true and partly not true, Paul, because if you look at the kinds of books of poetry that are awarded the prizes, it's not usually the most difficult writing. Right. It's rare for one of those books to be given a prize. It happens sometimes. It all depends on the jury. But for the most part, and particularly we have this, I don't know if you tune into CBC from Seattle, but we have this Canada Reads competition. And that, you know, that's the lowest common denominator of reading, I think.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, fair enough. We mentioned the Dogen quote in the book. You thank Zasep Tolku Rinpoche, I'm guessing your Tibetan Lama guru, right? Can you talk about how Buddhism is an influence on your work and how that informs it?
Yeah, I never feel satisfied that that there's enough of it in my work. It's always something that I'm reaching towards. It's partly the limitation of language. How do you even begin to talk about or evoke? Okay, it's the finger pointing at the moon. That's the most you can do. To the concept of shunyata, the sort of reality that underlies all these illusory realities that we cling to as concrete and present and permanent, and fool ourselves thereby, get ourselves stuck. Money is one of the big illusory concepts, and yet everyone slaves away for money, and our society is structured in such a way that you have to have it in order to basically survive.
Although I'm doing my best to prove that wrong.
Yeah, I know. And I see how people suffer. Here we have a high degree of homelessness, and people don't have enough money to buy food. They don't have enough money to have adequate housing. You know, there are people sleeping who can't stand the shelters with all their bugs and fights and everything else that goes on, attacks. And so they find places to sleep outside in this pouring rain.
A homeless man told me yesterday that he was enjoying the sunshine.
So, I don't know if that answers your question, but it seems to me that if we're writing, I don't want to just write about my daily life, my daily experiences, without trying to push it towards something that is aimed at liberating consciousness, to use a cliche term. And obviously you feel the same way. And there's always the difficulty, okay, like how can you do that and still make it readable for people to get there, readable enough for people to get a glimpse of what could be. And that's the struggle in writing. That's always my struggle. I don't want people to have to have a whole theoretical background to read my work. But I do want them to be pulled into it. And I've had people say to me, well, the thing about your poetry is that you really make me present. Your writing really makes me present in it. And that's exactly what I want. I want them to be present in it.
You know, it's interesting that the CBC documentary on Joni Mitchell, that was a 2-hour interview at her house in California, she said that if you are not seeing yourself in my work, then I haven't done my job. And you know, you listen, and I'm sure you've had the experience of listening to Blue when you're depressed and just crying along with it and just feeling so deeply a sense of what you might have been going through and what you're going through through that.
Yeah.
Would you like to end by reading a selection from the book and of your choosing?
Yeah, I'll read one of the new poems, because we've been talking mainly about the old poems. Okay, I'll read Snowed, the one with the Dogen quote. I wanted to write a poem about the mountains here, because they're so much a part of the... And they're not... In a sense, they're not part of the city, they're the background to the city. But they're so much more than background. They have to be so much more present in our daily realization of them.
My first trip to Vancouver was an anniversary with my first wife, and we came at night and through a snowstorm in Bellingham, and we saw lights out in the distance, and the next day when we woke up, we realized those were lights on the mountain.
Yes, right.
And it was like, holy shit, the mountains are right there.
Yeah.
It was a stunning feeling. Yeah. And that was 1989 or 1990, yeah. Something like that. Yeah. So it was a long time ago.
I always feel I feel pained when people come to the city when it's like this, it's totally cloudy. You have no idea there are mountains there. They never see the mountains, and then they leave. Like, whoa, they miss so much.
Like Mount Rainier in Seattle.
Yeah. Well, we have our sacred mountains, actually. Baker is, even though it's across the border, I think of it as our sacred mountain, too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Snowed. Blue under white diminishing habitat, oblivious up where Nivian cloud feathering granite shoulder sparse coal neck infrasonic down grouse goat camel crown from snowmelt rapiding creek strain snowline loud gravel graveling face off mountain down. Where night news warm sky transforms illumined towers exhale power in the Freudian body of Wi-Fi access urban unconscious crossing a known threshold. Mark high voltage zone. You flip your wig, throw your stole over a theater chair, the show's ongoing Omnimax 3D transitions, the first global, the, they said as if permanent, image boxes, ice where sea covered, or will where sky train and light snowdrop, and Sakura where war cuts steel, the intended a sprocket railway up grouse ends. Close up graupel or lattice high resolution omits touch at the headlong rate we're going, snow dulls hearing, eye blink diffusion, rhythms a different look. Mountains walking. Just like human walking.
May it be so.
Yes.
Thanks so much for your time.
You're welcome, Paul.